May 13th, Business and Consumer Affairs Committee meeting.
House Committee on Business and Consumer Affairs will come to order. Clerk will note those members present. Good afternoon and welcome to the committee on Friday the 13th. With that, we're going to have a public hearing on three bills, and I'll start House Bill 2662, and I notice Representative Marsh is here and Representative Fromar. Are you testifying together or separately?
Together.
Good. Well, that's very, very auspicious for Friday the 13th.
Don't remind us, please. Good afternoon. I'm State Representative Tom Marsh from District 5 in Washington County. I've provided each of you with a copy of my testimony on House Bill 2662, and if you would, I'd appreciate it if you'd follow through with me. I appear before you this afternoon in support of House Bill 2662. Simply stated, the bill would make it an unlawful employment practice to discriminate in hiring based on one's marital or family relationship. My hope is that the committee will include the following amendment as it deliberates the bill. In line 5 of the printed bill, after hire, insert, quote, or to terminate the employment of, end quote. Completion of the line is printed. The practice of discriminating against a prospective or even current employee because of his or her marital or family relationship is well known and all too commonly used by both public and private employers. Some companies and governmental bodies include the policy in their personnel manuals, for example, Fred Meyer and First National Bank of Oregon. Others, on the other hand, apply it as unwritten practice. School districts are common practitioners of this method. On the second page of my testimony, I have lifted from the bank policy manual of First National Bank the section as it applies to the employment of spouses or our relatives. Relatives. A. Immediate family. A member of an employee's or director's immediate family may not be hired for employment with the bank, either on a temporary, permanent, part-time, or full-time basis. The definition of immediate family for employment purposes includes father, mother, son, daughter, sister, brother, grandmother, grandfather, grandchildren, adopted children, stepchildren, foster children, spouse, mother-in-law, father-in-law, sister-in-law, brother-in-law, daughter-in-law, son-in-law. If after employment two employees marry or become members of the same immediate family through marriage, the two may remain in the employ of the bank. However, the two may not work in the same branch or department, or one may not be in a position where he or she can influence the career of the other. If two employees become related after employment and they work in the same branch, department, or control area, one employee must transfer out of the unit within 90 days. Other. Relatives of staff members or directors, other than those listed as immediate family, may be employed by the bank, as long as they meet all hiring standards and requirements. It's interesting to note that the upper echelons of management have a little bit more leeway in hiring their family members than do the other employees of the company. On the next page, we have the document lifted from the Fred Meyer personnel manual. We have highlighted in yellow employment of relatives. A relative of yours may also be employed by Fred Meyer Incorporated, as long as he or she is not a member of your immediate family living under the same roof. If you have minor children, they may not be employed, whether or not they live at home. Because of possible conflicts of interest, it is the policy not to hire employees who are related to management supervising employees of companies who are in competition with Fred Meyer. Somewhat of a different issue there. I just bring to you two examples here today from two large companies in Oregon to show that the policy is really very much in effect, at least in those two concerns. Now, Representative Fromar has some more comments, and then Nellie Fox from the AFL-CIO will be adding some more comments.
All right, fine. And we'll save our questions at that point. Representative Fromar.
Thank you, Representative Grinnell. I'm Dave Fromar, State Representative District 40,
testifying in support of 2662, of which I'm a co-sponsor. I won't cover the same ground as Representative Marsh. I wish simply to add some additional considerations for the committee, primary among which is that as long as this practice is permitted, that is, the present practice of refusing to hire members of an individual family, no matter how qualified they may be, I believe that Oregon employers indirectly are subjecting themselves to the possibility of a civil rights suit for discrimination on the basis of sex. I say that because the historical operation of these nepotism policies has been to act against the interests of the female member of the tandem team. That's not de jure, that's de facto. That's what in fact usually happens. And at least in public higher education, where the federal authorities have been enforcing discrimination, anti-discrimination laws, they've made it very clear, and this goes for the Office of Civil Rights of HEW and also for the Department of Labor and also, I believe, for the Justice Department. They have demanded that institutions under their affirmative action plans strike out nepotism, anti-nepotism clauses because of their potential for creating discrimination against females, even though females may be equally qualified. This is a familiar issue to me because 5 years ago when I was acting on behalf of the administration of the University of Oregon, assisting the State Board of Higher Education, we were successful in getting both the university and the state board to change their nepotism policies and substitute in their stead a conflict of interest policy, which has worked remarkably well. It seems to me if there's anything at the root of a notion that you can't hire a family member, it is the notion that somehow undue favoritism will come to bear and questions of salary, promotion, hiring, or other possibly collusive relationships between the two employees that are undesirable in terms of the best interests of the business or of the institution. It seems to me that if that's the policy that nepotism is directed against, it's overly broad, and one can just as easily, by instituting a conflict of interest policy, target the real potential abuse of people who are married or related by blood that are hired by the same firm. It's absurd to me that if you're an employee of a bank, that your spouse may work for another branch of that bank or even within that bank, assuming that employee doesn't have any direct control over your salary or otherwise dictate your job. So it seems to me that with the substitution of a conflict of interest policy, as is already in force, this change throughout the state could get at the evil that this employment practice is designed to prevent without being unnecessarily restrictive of the employment opportunities of individuals. My final thought is simply this, that the whole object of the anti-discrimination laws is really to further a basic objective in our society, and that is that an individual be considered on his or her own merits, irrespective of belonging to a class, a race, or in this case, a family. It seems to me it's a sensible policy to pursue, and I think the bill is good because of it. One final point I'll make, and that is that if you notice Section 1 of the statute, it says that you cannot refuse to hire solely on the basis of a family relationship. Obviously, if that family relationship together with other factors would make the existence of the two employees undesirable in terms of the objective of the business, that would not preclude the refusal to hire, and it seems to me that that's a sensible addition. That's, I believe, the main thrust of the remarks I'd like to leave with you. I think the alternative of a conflict of interest policy is clearly workable. It is working in state institutions already, and it seems to me that it would not be that difficult to implement.
Thank you, Dave. Questions, sure. Representative Achilles?
David, in respect of your conflict of interest approach, would the second paragraph of, I'm sure this is your testimony, Tom, perhaps I should address it to you, on the First National Bank statement, the second paragraph in 4, if after employment two employees marry, is that permissible under the Act? Are those kinds of restrictions permissible under the Act?
You're speaking about after they become married and redirect employment so that there's no conflict. As far as I can tell, yes, there's no problem there.
There's a real need within a financial institution, for example, where there are systems of checks and balances built in all the way through. We're dealing, obviously, with the depositors' funds. There's a real need to be able to make those kinds of distinctions.
Well, financial institutions have traditionally assumed a position believing that that is the case, to protect against collusion in particular, they move the one employee out of that branch more often than not.
And there's clearly nothing within the bill that would affect that.
I don't see it.
Thank you.
The bill, as it's written, by the way, refers solely to refusal to hire.
Right.
It says nothing about transfer, promote, nor in its present state, if you don't adopt Representative Marsh's bill, does it say anything about terminate.
Further questions? Representative Shaw?
Yeah, I have a little problem with this, Dave and Tom, and seems like it should work both directions. We had a courthouse in Douglas County that said to look like a family tree.
Well, but it seems to me the response to that is to have an effective conflict of interest policy. Such a, it ought to cut both ways. That is, there shouldn't be any favoritism due to family relationships.
That's the problem.
And there ought not to be any discrimination because of it. My goodness sakes, though, we've crossed that issue with respect to race and crossed it with respect to sex discrimination. I don't know that it's any more difficult. And the Hatch Act should long ago, or not the Hatch Act, but other types of merit systems of public employee hiring should be targeted to attack that kind of problem.
Another question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bringing greetings from the Judiciary Committee, which is also at work today.
Good. I'm glad to see that we're going to hurry and hurriedly conclude the session by working even on Friday the 13th. Ellie Fox.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I do appreciate your diligence on Friday afternoon, Friday the 13th. I'm Nellie Fox, Legislative and Political Director of the Oregon AFL-CIO. House Bill 2662 was introduced as a result of a resolution submitted by the Lumber and Production Industrial Workers Union, which is the former Lumber and Sawmill Workers Union, and it was adopted unanimously by our statewide convention. The problem addressed by House Bill 2662 is one that has plagued our workers for many years, and while it applies to many family relationships, it most often causes discrimination to the woman in a husband and wife employment situation. As a business representative of the Retail Clerks Union, I've had many a grievance filed because of this unfair company policy. In one instance, a wife was terminated because her husband worked for a rival retail establishment. And while this bill does not exactly solve this type of problem, I cite it to show you the unreasonable attitude of some of the companies toward their employees. Some unions have been successful in negotiating it into their contract. However, it is a very difficult objective to obtain, especially in retail area. It would not be a strike issue. But even with it in contracts, it does not help the non-union worker, nor would it apply to hiring policies where the individual is not yet a member of the union. And I would refer you to two attached exhibits. One is an example from one of the larger corporations of our area, and it is to Mike Herford, who is now the president of Retail Clerks Local 1092, just as recently as July 20th of 1976. And it shows you their application of their company policy. I'll just read part of it too. It says, as a general rule, when two employees of the firm get married while both are concurrently employed, we permit both to continue to work until one or the other terminates. Consideration for reemployment, however, is subsequently subject to the company's published employment policy. And this person voluntarily left the employment but could not be rehired because her spouse is currently employed. This is an example of one of the problems that we have had with it. The other exhibit is testimony that has come from the Roseburg area that addresses a different facet of the problem. And I'll read it for the record. It has been the practice and the rule at the mills of a large company in the Roseburg area not to hire the spouse of an employee. At one time, if the company found out a couple working there were married, then one of the couple had to quit. This was a part of the company printed rules and has since been negotiated out of the rules. This practice still exists where a supervisor and an employee marry, even though the supervisor works in a separate plant than the production employee. The hiring practice is not to hire a spouse, and questions asking for relatives are on the application blank. The places of employment are scattered over a 25-mile radius and serviced by two different industrial unions, but still the same rule applies. In an attempt to beat the rule, some people have resorted to filing the self-help divorce papers, trying to get a job, and others have changed their name back to their maiden names and have falsified their applications to be considered for employment. Many have sought help from the unions, but how do you process a grievance for a non-member? Also, the unions are told by the company, we're not going to be told whom to hire. It looks strange to us that it is okay to hire two different individuals who carry different last names but have been living together in a common law way. They can seek and receive employment, but when they cross the legal boundary and marry and become one, then one of the two is no longer eligible for employment. We ask the law be amended with teeth in it to accomplish its purpose. This was submitted by the president of the Lumber and Sawmill Workers Union from Roseburg. The illustrations that I've cited are only from a couple of the areas that I'm most familiar with. However, there are many other fields that this type of discrimination is flourishing, and we think it's time that stop and would request your support for this measure.
Thank you, Nellie. Questions?
I have a question.
Representative Morris.
Why is this not a strike issue? Yeah. Magnitude of it?
Yes, that's probably the most important issue on it, Representative Morris, that there, it, as long as it doesn't affect a majority of the employees, people being as selfish as they are, they're not going to take that as a strike.
If you had several issues, has there been a circumstance in which this has been thrown into the pot, so to speak?
Yes, it has been included in certain requests or bargaining proposals, but when you get down to the nitty-gritty, it is not one that the employers are willing enough to strike over, because it doesn't apply to everybody, and they are looking at it. Going on strike is a very serious issue, and unless it's very considerable, employees are reluctant to take that action.
Further questions? Representative Bryan.
Well, along that line, I think, Representative Morris, I had an instance when I was about 18, 19, trying to get my first job in Cottage Grove, which is pretty much used to be a one-mill town with a warehouser, in which they wouldn't hire me because my cousin worked there who had the same last name, and so we had a problem. You know, it didn't really affect him any, so why should he go out on strike to get me a job? I think it's sort of the situation. I'm not sure if they have those policies as a rule or not, but that was one of the reasons given me why I couldn't go to work there.
Maybe there are other reasons
that didn't work. At one time, I myself was kind of a victim in that same way. I applied for employment, and because my husband's nephew was employed by the same company, I was refused employment.
Another question? Thank you, Dylan.
Thank you.
John Minter.
My wife was going to read this, but she came up with laryngitis, and I really haven't read it over that much. But her name is Frieda Minter, and we live in Central Point, Oregon. I'd like to say that I deeply am grateful that I would like to thank you for being given the opportunity to come to Salem and talk on this matter. I found out about this bill from a lady in the Civil Rights Division in Portland. I connected her by phone before I applied for a job where my husband is presently employed. She She informed me that unless I first applied for the job, I was denied employment, that of course there would be nothing I could do. But if I was denied employment and sent in a complaint of discrimination, they then could check into it for me. I did not send in the complaint, of course, but after finding out about this bill, nothing was promised by this person, but later she called me and informed me of this bill. My husband has worked under the same employment for 19 years this August. He is here today with me and feels strongly as I do on this matter. We feel that if a person does not want to come, does not want her or his spouse working on the same, on the job with them, that they have decided in privacy of their own home. But I do believe it should affect the ones that do. But I do not believe it should affect the ones that do. I also feel that if one member of the family is working in the office and another member of the family is working in the plant of the same employment, that it would not mean that conspiracy would occur any faster than friends and so forth worked under the same situation. I feel that family has nothing to do with this. I also feel that people who promote their own family, if it is not their turn to be promoted, is doing others injustice as well as the company. But I believe that it would be no problem if handled properly by the employer. I applied for a job where my husband works and was denied employment. One foreman at this plant has three brothers and two sons working for this company, of which one son is under him. I therefore feel that I am definitely being discriminated against and I am not being judged for my own abilities, health, and so forth. I am not the only wife that has applied for a job and has been denied. One lady is having to drive past this point and is driving 26 miles a day to her job and takes a separate car from her husband. I feel differently when only men were employed, but as of 2 years ago last month, they started employing women. I definitely am a woman and yet am told that I cannot work at this plant because of a marriage license, of which I do not feel is fair. There are common law marriages between some of the employees. I believe in marriage. I do not believe in this should be used against you in seeking employment. When I asked for an application, I took a witness with me as I was informed by a lawyer to do so. There are two offices and two separate buildings which consists of seven different departments. I feel that on the same shift there, where the family would have a home life, that if it could be arranged for them, but for them to be put in different departments on the job. My sister was allowed to seek employment under this firm and was hired. She went with me one afternoon to two separate trailer parks to take a petition on how many people agreed with us on this matter. In one afternoon, about 3.5 hours, and got about 126 signatures. There were comments made and were only refused by one person who said that she never signed anything. Also, one owner of a company signed, which does show me that I'm not the only one who feels this way on this matter. I feel there would be better gas conservation and well as better marital relationships. A job that I am qualified to do would pay over a dollar less than I could make at this company, which I am speaking of. This is a starting wage, of course. It means a great deal to me to have been able to come and give my opinion on this bill. I thank you very much for your time and consideration and would like to urge you to vote on this bill.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Klein.
I'd just like to thank the members for driving all the way up from Central Point and having prepared testimony and everything, being a representative from that city. I know and appreciate how long and far it is to drive.
That's good testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, we'll put that in our record.
Hope you get over your laryngitis. Okay. Is there anyone else wishing to appear on House Bill 2662? Yes. Had you signed up? I'm sorry. Is it Sandra Vitron or Vitron? All right.
She had laryngitis. I've got butterflies. All right.
Just take a deep breath.
Hyperventilate. I'm Sandy Vitron, and I'm here from the Dalles. I was the victim of a nepotism ruling at a hospital, and with another woman that I am citing here in this paper. And I've gone back to college now because I couldn't get my job back after fighting it for over a year. And I'm taking a psychology women's course, and in that we're studying nepotism. That's one of the reasons I came today. Oregon has prided herself in being a leader in progressive legislation. To take affirmative action against discriminating anti-nepotism policies is another step in assuring fair and humane treatment of Oregon residents. Historically, nepotism was the practice of authority figures to place unskilled nephews in key positions to ensure political backing. However, today, anti-nepotism practices are more likely to be business policies that limit the abilities and potential of many skilled workers. Let me cite two cases in particular. A young woman in McMinnville has worked hard to obtain a degree in education. Her children are all in school now, and she would like to pursue her chosen career. There are two job openings in the local junior high, and she meets the qualifications. However, her husband is already employed at the school, so that when she goes for a job interview, she is refused before her qualifications are even considered. The reason for denying her an application is that sometime in the future, she and her husband might have marital problems that would have a detrimental effect upon the children at school. In the Dalles, another woman who is employed at a local hospital is shocked to receive a termination notice. After over a year's employment, this extremely talented woman is to be dismissed because the hospital board has initiated an anti-nepotism policy as a good business practice, and the woman works in her husband's department. The area doctors unanimously approached the board to reconsider their decision, as the woman has specialized skills not available through any other person in the hospital, but the board's decision remains firm. Both of these women made the same mistake. They attended college and dared to date and fall in love with men in their own field. With their subsequent marriages, they unknowingly limited their future opportunities to be able to practice their professional skills. An awareness of such problems is beginning to develop across the country, and individuals are being hired according to their abilities, no matter what their family relationship is. Stanford University has initiated hiring of relatives based on individual merit, and the University of the State of New York has stated that colleges and universities should encourage adequate career opportunities for women faculty members and administrators by such arrangements as eliminating nepotism rules. People who take affirmative action against anti-nepotism rulings are often considered to be nuisance cases. However, they are real people trying to defend what is very meaningful to themselves personally. An understanding of these feelings is expressed by the statement included in the Oregon Fair Employment Practices Act that says, hiring of relatives. a rule which prohibits members of the same family from working for the same employer usually denies the female equal opportunity for employment, thereby causing discrimination. Members of the same family shall be employed on the merits of their individual qualifications and performance. Specific problems involving such employment should be dealt with by employers as individual situations without the use of a general rule. I realize that my argument has been slanted toward the feminine gender, but in the future it is very possible that males could be just as much affected. Neither sex should be limited in developing their full human potential by the negating influence of anti-nepotism practices. There is a great deal said today in support of female equality. That is fine. But I ask for more. I ask for human equality. It is within the realm of this legislature to further that equality. Let's take seriously the inalienable right to the pursuit of happiness.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much for a very good testimony. Is there anyone else wishing to appear on House Bill 2662? Yes, sir.
Very briefly, Mr. Chairman, my name is Simon Fitch, and I'm speaking for the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. I think the issues have been well addressed already by the previous witnesses, and I'm appearing simply to say that we also support this bill and the concept. Our board considered the bill and took a vote in favor, so I just wanted to convey that to the committee.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Bob.
Is there any legal recourse for people in the state now that are, such as the previous witness who was terminated because of this type of action?
I'm not an attorney, Representative Fawbush. As I understand it, the only recourse would be, as one of the previous witnesses mentioned, an appeal or a filing of a complaint of some sort of discrimination with the State Civil Rights Division of the Bureau of Labor. That would only work out if you could feel, if you felt that you could establish sex discrimination, race discrimination, discrimination because of marital relationships or familial relationships is not presently prohibited by state law.
Representative Fawbush, I believe Pat Hagen is here from the Bureau of Labor and could answer those questions for you if you'd like.
Yeah.
All right. Fine. Pat, why don't you come on out?
Yes, the sex discrimination guidelines for the state of Oregon prohibit that nepotism discrimination if we can show that it has an effect on one sex or the other. That is very difficult to show in most of the cases that people are bringing forth today. As an example of where it would be sex discrimination, I had a call from a fire department who said, we want to pass a new personnel policy that says no spouses may apply or may work for the fire department. And I said, well, how many women do you have working for the department? They said, well, it's 100% male. So in that case, indeed, we could show that one sex was being affected by the practice, but that's very difficult to show in the cases that are coming before you now.
That answer your question?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much, Ken. Anyone else wishing to appear on House Bill 2662? If not, that concludes the hearing. Senate Bill 298. And John Wolf, please.
Probably see the handwriting on the wall.
Good afternoon.
afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Wolf. I'm executive assistant to Bill Stevenson, Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor. I'm here to testify in support of Senate Bill 298. Under existing wage and hour law, an employer may avoid the penalty for non-payment of wages by showing inability to pay the wages at the time they accrued. This essentially is a built-in loophole for the most serious type of violation of our wage laws. Senate Bill 298 removes this defense in lines 10 through 12 of the A. and Gross bill. However, the main change in the statute provided in 298 is in subsection 3 of the A. and Gross bill. The statute currently provides that the Labor Commissioner accept wage assignments in order to collect minimum wage and overtime pay due to an employee. There is a difference of opinion among Bureau of Labor Legal Counsel, which are Assistant Attorneys General, as to whether the Bureau of Labor can collect wages due without the filing of a wage claim. Such cases come to the attention of the Bureau of Labor either through the processing and investigation of a filed claim or through routine inspections. As amended, subsection 3 would permit the Bureau of Labor to collect wages without the filing of individual wage claims. Currently, the federal government, the U.S. Department of Labor's Wage and Hour Division, has such authority under Section 17 of the Fair Labor Standards Act. The bill provides that the Bureau of Labor would pay attorney fees in addition to other costs and disbursements should the Bureau of Labor not prevail in a suit filed pursuant to this subsection. It is our belief that this provision is fair and will deter abuse which might arise through the frivolous prosecution of suits.
Representative Morris.
Have you lines what, 10 through 12 remove the defense?
Correct.
All right. Have you ever served as an employer?
Myself personally, no, I have not.
You've never served as an employer, you've always served as an employee?
I've always been an employee.
Okay. I served as an employer for, I don't know, a dozen Baker years. And there were circumstances when it got pretty tough as to whether I was going to be able to meet the payroll on the 15th or the 1st, because there are just no centavos. How is this being abused?
Essentially what we have are situations, you know, albeit there are not a great many of these situations, but where an employer is using the labor of the employee on the basis of credit. And when the regular paydays come along, either once a month or twice a month or once a week, I think an employee has the right to expect to be paid on the basis of work actually performed. In some cases, the employer has not been able to pay those wages and has known that that situation exists. This, we believe, is the most serious type of violation. In other words, where the employer essentially and knowingly, you'll see the term willfully in the law, we would have to prove willful violation under this section, under existing law, has knowingly used the employee's labor on the basis of credit and has not been able to pay that employee. We think to provide this specific out is unfair to the employee and possibly removes any deterrent to that type of action.
Well, let's take a circumstance where, you know, I've met payroll and I've never had a problem, and sometimes you don't know if you're going to meet payroll till you make a deposit the day before payday, and I blow it. I just flat don't have it, and the bank isn't going to let me write those checks. So I can't meet the payroll. Now, that's one set of circumstance. First time I've missed payroll in 8 years, okay? We'll just take that circumstance. Mm-hmm. Measure that against an individual that persistently goes through this thrombosis and misses payrolls. Do you see a distinction?
Yes, I certainly do. And
well, there is no distinction if this language is removed.
The statute 652150 specifically imposes the penalties for willful violations of the law.
Well, it's perfectly willful that I did it because I don't have the money to do it. I mean, it's totally willful. I just simply didn't have the money in the bank. on that particular time, first payroll I've missed in 8 years, and it's flat willful because there's just no money.
She would be subject to the fine if it were a bit willful.
But you just got through telling me you saw a variance between the guy that missed it once in 8 years and the guy that missed it consistently. But you don't allow any latitude. You don't allow any judgmental latitude. And I submit that if you're going to remove the exemption, that there are circumstances in which it just, there should be some latitude.
Well, I think the existing statute doesn't provide any latitude either.
I didn't say that was right.
And the penalties are fairly imposed on all who willfully violate the statute, whether they willfully violate it once or 30 times.
Well, one wrong doesn't make the next one right.
Correct.
All right. Then I'm asking if your office would be interested in trying to work out something that's equitable. So the guy that's met that payroll for 8 years doesn't get clobbered by your office just because he flat couldn't meet payroll once in 8 years.
Well, we can only impose penalties up to 30 days, and I don't know how much the clobbering would be in that particular situation.
I don't care if you can, what the clobbering is, I'm asking what's fair.
I think we'd be more than willing to discuss the fairness of this. I don't think we have any problem doing that.
I want to get the guy's abusement, but I don't want to get the guy's...
Okay. I'd be willing to discuss that with you if you wish to work on it.
Representative Cairns.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I, along those same lines, let me ask you, Mr. Wolf, a couple of questions. Your basic intent is to see that labor is paid for its efforts is not correct.
Correct.
Okay, so if somebody works 2 weeks and then his employer doesn't come across with the money, then that is a problem for the employer, but it's also can be very direct economic consequences to the employee.
Right.
Numbers of employees, isn't that right?
Correct.
Okay. So that one has an interest in being fair and not zapping somebody who, because of having the shorts 1 year out of 10, passes a very serious economic consequence down to his employees, and I'm sure that person who's got a good heart feels bad about that. But isn't that really the issue?
Yes, that's how we see it.
Okay, now let me ask you this in practice. What happens, how do these things come to your attention? How do these kind of things come to your attention? Almost always it's a matter of an action on the part of an employee who has not received compensation. Is that
right.
Not correct?
Right. We can only take action against the employer under existing law when a wage claim is filed.
Okay. So what happens if you get a raft of claims in from five or six people all call you up, same company, and says, this joker didn't pay us, we're on a monthly basis, here we are, we didn't even get 10 cents on the dollar, we're up the creek. You go down there and you talk to them, what do? You go down there...
We'll have the individual employees file individual wage claims.
Okay, and then what do?
We will generally bring the employer, a demand letter will be sent to the employer in which we indicate to the employer that he may come in for a scheduled conference with where we have the complainant, and if the complainant has legal counsel, and the employer and the employer's counsel, they'll come in, sit down with the wage and hour inspector, and go over the facts of the case.
Okay. Now, what happens in that instance? The guy, the employer comes in and says, you know, willfully or not, I got short. First time this happened to me in 10 years, I got short, and you'll see that I've always paid on time. Here are my records, I've always paid on time. I'm going to have the money in 2 days, and people are going to be, 8 days late, but there it is. Sorry, I couldn't help it. What would you do? Normally. What would you do?
Well, under this, we would, unless the guy went into receivership or went bankrupt, we would collect the wages, and because he didn't have the money to pay the wages at the time, no penalty would be imposed under the existing law.
But under this change,
then the penalty would be imposed.
And the penalty is?
Equal to the rate of pay up to 30 days. The length of time that the person was not paid, up to and including 30 days.
And there's no discretion in that.
I'm trying to quickly reread this. No, there's not. It says shall.
So the guy misses once in 10 years is in the same case as the guy who's a scufflaw and a rat and a fink who's always cheating his employees and just being a bum. And a,
yes.
Isn't that right?
Yes. And if we want to work on making distinction there, I think that's a reasonable thing to do.
I think that's fair.
Mr. Chairman?
Sure.
Representative Killis and then Representative Vian.
John, when a company goes bankrupt now, the creditors have certain priorities. The government comes out first. Where does this?
13 is coming up, and I have some comment on that.
Would this in any way change those priorities?
No. Senate Bill 313 will not change your priorities either.
Any other questions?
Nothing.
Vian.
Well, this is more of a statement than a question, as usually I do, but I would feel a lot more sympathy and concern about this, except that if my employer doesn't pay me and I don't make my bank payment, the bank still assesses me the penalty, whether I've missed one in 8 years or not. And same does the credit finance company and all my other loan installments. If I don't make them on time, they assess me, whether I've made them faithfully for 10 years or whether I miss them every month. So it seems to me like if we want to be fair, maybe we should write something into the statutes that say you can't assess a person a penalty unless they are a scufflaw, as Representative Kearns phrases it.
Defined in
scufflaw. Willful is awfully difficult to prove, and
I don't even have to willfully miss mine. All I got to do is miss it.
The original Senate Bill 298 had removed willfully, but in discussion with the Senate committee that handled this bill, willfully was restored as protection.
Okay. Willfully means someone who has the funds and secretes them someplace.
No.
Someone deliberately attempts to,
no.
to deny compensation to an employee or
there,
what?
There may be a variety of ways that he would willfully do it. That person may have known well in advance that the money would not be there. He's paying the purveyors or what have you, meeting those obligations, and so I'll make up the slack by delaying the payday.
Okay.
It's not likely that an employer is going to think that he can get away completely without paying these people, but they may delay the payday, and that's why it's the same, equal to the rate of pay for each day up to and including 30 days.
Chairman, question, Representative Kearns? Representative Achilles.
It strikes me that if, for example, as Monday is a payroll day, that I as an employer could be accused of willfully being in violation of this act simply by virtue of having paid some other bills during the course of this last week rather than accumulating the funds for the payroll.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's rather a broad, I think if somebody wanted to, they could interpret willfully very broadly here.
Well, the courts are really take a pretty stringent line on what is a willful violation. And, in fact, the reason we agreed to restore willfully is a recent Oregon Supreme Court case, and I'll give you the citation on that case. I have a copy of the case with me that I could leave with the clerk for your review, but it's a December 23rd, 1976 case, number 299, Sabin versus Willamette Westing. And in that, it's too long to read now, but the committee would find some court guidelines as to what a willful violation actually is. And it's very hard to prove willful.
I would like to see that, Mr. Chairman, if you make
I
a will.
Gladly. Okay.
You'd provide that to the committee?
Yes.
Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Wolf?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, you express a willingness to somehow separate the good guys and the bad guys, or stair-step this thing somehow to, you know, give, you know, the first bite being free or almost free, and the second bite being expensive, and the third one, I presume, you just
hang
them. What are you going to have some recommendations for?
Well, that was an alternative that was raised in the Senate committee. Senator Carson felt strongly that if we maintain the term willfully, that was a fairly good protection. Although we did discuss the possibility of a stepped or graduated penalty system instead of the straight 30-day situation, I discussed that with our attorneys and with the commissioner, and we have no problem with that as an alternative. You know, we can negotiate.
Can you bring us some language so we can look at it?
Yes, I will do that.
When's the bill on for work session, Mr. Chairman?
Not until we have that information, Representative Cairns.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll have it for you.
All right.
Monday, probably.
All right. Thank you, John. Further questions? Comments? Is there anyone else wishing to appear on Senate Bill 298? Not that closes the hearing on that bill. Why don't you just stay there, John?
Okay.
And we'll open the hearing on Senate Bill 313.
The purpose of this bill is to put Oregon wage and hour statutes regarding preferred debt in conformity with the Federal Bankruptcy Act. On page 2, line 10 of the printed bill, the preferred debt due each employee is increased from $300 to $600. The relevant federal statute is found in section 64A, subsection 2 of the Bankruptcy Act, 11 U.S.C. 104. The proposed bill would more accurately reflect a reasonable share of the distribution of assets. Originally, $300 was thought to be a reasonable share for wages earned within 90 days of seizure, receivership, or assignment. However, $600 appears to be a more reasonable figure in the light of present wage patterns and the inflationary pressures which have affected all areas of economic life. The statute has not been amended since its enactment in 1951. So that $300 figure has been on the books since 1951, and as you're all aware, inflation has grown rapidly since that time.
When was it?
1950.
Yes, Representative Moore.
When was it changed? When was the last time?
1951.
Are you sure $600 is enough?
It probably not, from my own point of view, but I think it is in line with the Federal Bankruptcy Act, and that's one of the things we're trying to do is remove the confusion that employers may have. Under bankruptcy, it's a $600 preferred debt to the each employee over a 90-day period. Under the state law dealing with receivership and seizures, it's $300, and this would make it consistent, our law consistent with the federal bankruptcy law.
Further questions? Thank you, John. Anyone else wishing to appear on Senate Bill 313? Not, that concludes the hearing.
John, I appreciate if you get that material to us by Monday, because I'd like to schedule those for work session as soon as possible. Thank you. Senate Bill 714. And first I'll call, is it Mary Lee? Is that Oshiro? All right, good. I'm doing better today.
Yeah, I'm moving
two for two.
Sure. I think he was the table. Well,
I'm Mary Lee Oshiro from Milwaukee, Oregon. There'll be two testimonies passed out. One is from Ann Feeney, who wanted to testify and couldn't, so I brought her testimony along. I would like to testify in support of Senate Bill 14, which would eliminate maternity-related discrimination. My main 2 points are, first, the way in which company policies discriminate against pregnant women, and secondly, to show that the basis for this discrimination is false. The organization for which I work has a group health disability insurance plan, which does not cover disability due to pregnancy for any reason. My experience personally was fortunate. it was necessary for me to take 3 weeks off work to have surgery done on my cervix and stay off my feet or lose the baby. My employers paid for my time off. However, it was an optional choice for them. The health and disability insurance definitely would not pay disability benefits since I was disabled due to pregnancy-related causes. However, under many company policies, as in Ann Kelly Feeney's testimony, an employee could attempt suicide and receive disability after 8 days and up to 13 weeks. A person could elect to take their life and receive benefits, but not give life and receive benefits. In many policies, other elective procedures are covered, such as cosmetic surgery or other avoidable conditions, such as those resulting from skiing accidents. Fortunately, again, my employer's insurance policy is progressive. After July 1st, pregnancy and related illnesses will be covered in the disability clause. It will benefit many others in my situation in the future. It appears pregnancy is excluded from disability and other related benefits because it is considered an elected condition. This is not necessarily true. Working in a family planning clinic, I have found that no matter how conscientious a person is, our modern methods of contraception are not 100% effective. Please see the attached chart on effectiveness of several accepted methods of contraception. Even sterilization procedures are not considered 100% effective. The chart shows the theoretical, that is used correctly and consistently, effectiveness versus the actual effectiveness for 100 women using a method for 1 year. Can most pregnancies from contraceptive failures be considered elective? In summary, I support Senate Bill 714 in hopes of stopping discrimination against women through unjust practices.
Thank you very much. That was very good testimony. And if you just would like the statement from Ann Kelly Feeney just to be placed in the record. Fine. Right. Questions? Does he mean a question, Representative Karen?
Well, I'm trying to discover this. I'm really trying to discover the scope of the bill because I haven't gone back and looked at the reference to 659030. What is it we're really doing as far as we're simply saying that...
clarifies the definition of
sex discrimination.
Yep.
That's
659 is the
okay.
Civil
right. Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Let's see, Nellie Fox, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Nellie Fox, legislative and political director of the Oregon AFL-CIO. And we're here today to add our voice of support for this bill. Here again, I dip back into my past experiences with the retail clerks union. As business representative, one of the biggest problems of dealing with segments of employment have been in the area of restoring a person's job because of pregnancy leave, getting pregnancy benefits included into our health and welfare provisions, and just in the whole area of problems relating to this. We've had many, many cases of just blatant discrimination, people being terminated because as soon as their pregnancy has become known due to a company policy. So this is why we are in support of that. Our national organization, the Retail Clerks International Association, are lending their support very wholeheartedly to the passage of a bill in the National Congress. It's House H.R. 6075, and that would, of course, be the ideal way to go, but until that transpires, we would be supportive of this one for the Oregon State.
Thank you, Nellie. Questions? Thank you very much. Mr. John Lansing, another proponent. Opponent, I'm sorry, John. Hi, John. Come on up, John. It's all right.
you want.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, my name is John Lansing. I'm speaking for Blue Cross of Oregon. We are opposed to Senate Bill 714, as we feel that it will increase the cost of health care, and generally we believe that mandated benefits tend to be inflationary. We recognize that that taking an opposition stance on this kind of a bill is difficult both politically and socially. However, Blue Cross of Oregon and Blue Cross Association nationwide have been criticized for what has been described as our lack of involvement in not doing more to contain health care costs. That we are a funnel for the health care dollars in terms of subscribers paying through to us to providers of health care. In discussions outside of this room, in questioning Blue Cross's opposition, statements been made, well, why are you opposing pregnancy benefits or other mandated benefits? All you'll do is pass on those costs to subscribers. And that's what would happen. We would pass on those costs to our people. Blue Cross, as an insurance provider, would not assume those costs. And we feel that it's not responsible for us to take a position in allowing this kind of legislation to go through without pointing out to the legislative body that potentially this is going to increase the cost of health care. Pregnancy generally is a planned condition, and as such, it can be anticipated and planned for financially. And even if it's not planned for, even if the condition is not planned for, there still is a 9-month period to financially plan for the resultant costs of a child. Blue Cross testified in front of this committee a month or so ago on a House version of the pregnancy bill, and you have a copy of that that testimony in your bill books. That testimony applies to the maternity and pregnancy aspects of Senate Bill 714. 714, however, is broader in its discussion of employment-related activities. As an employer, we don't have any problems with the bill in those areas, except under benefits, under the benefit use of the 9-month waiting period, which would not be allowed. And we feel that the disallowance of that 9-month waiting period is not a sound underwriting practice. As a healthcare service contractor, we generally oppose mandated benefits on the basis that, for instance, Blue Cross and many other insurance companies provide these kinds of coverage on an optional basis. Mandating such benefits would drive up the monthly premium of the average group approximately 5 to 6%. In discussing financial impacts, I hope that you would consider those small companies whose workforce may be past the childbearing age. It may be necessary for those small employers to sacrifice needed or desired benefits that group would ordinarily purchase in order to provide pregnancy coverage when no one would use that coverage. As I mentioned, that 5 to 6% computes to a $4 million price tag for Blue Cross subscribers statewide, or approximately $4 to $5 extra per month, whether or not that benefit is used. Using the example of a large group, large employee group, Blue Cross covers the state of Oregon. The state of Oregon employee group premium would increase under the provisions of Senate Bill 714, a little over $1 million a year, or $2 million for the biennium. We estimate that if maternity had to be paid as any other illness, and this includes eliminating the 9-month waiting period, that the additional cost to the state on an annual basis would be $1,500,000. This would have to be financed through additional premiums paid by the subscriber, an increase in the state contribution, or a combination of both. This does not include costs associated with increased disability payments for lost time if pregnancy was considered as any other illness. Those costs would be passed on to the subscriber, and it's Blue Cross of Oregon's contention that we have a responsibility to hold down premium costs of health care for the health care user. As you're aware, there are other mandated bills which are currently before this committee and other legislative committees. Psychiatric benefits, mandated coverage for chiropractic benefits, naturopaths, podiatrists, and maternity. All of these add up to a significant increase of premium, and this can be viewed as inflationary, particularly when these kinds of coverages are now available to group purchasers based on their particular needs. And also, I might point out that these are negotiated items in union contracts. So in closing, Mr. Chairman, I would submit that due to the fiscal impact on the state of Oregon that this bill has, that further consideration might be made in the Ways and Means Committee. That concludes my testimony.
John, let me ask you a couple of questions. In most comprehensive plans with Blue Cross, are sterilizations, voluntary sterilization, is that usually covered under a group policy?
Vasectomies?
Yeah.
Yes, based on the desires of those groups purchasing those kinds of
products.
We do, if a group requests them, we do provide them.
What about plastic surgery?
For cosmetic
purposes?
No, not for cosmetic purposes. If it's like a burn that is a result of an accident, that would then be covered.
I guess what I'm going at or going toward, John, is this, that the consistency of the philosophy that in your initial part of your testimony was that it shouldn't be a pregnancy, something you can plan for. And I would imagine that probably a vasectomy is something you might plan for. I don't know how precipitous that might be, that you might all of a sudden make that decision. It would seem to me that that's a kind of an inconsistent philosophy for the company to hold. The other is, you say if you add a coverage or you mandate a coverage, then that's going to increase the rates or potentially increase the rates. Is that correct?
Yes.
And that's inflationary. So I suppose if you provide the reverse to that particular philosophy, the best insurance coverage would be that didn't cover anything
at all.
It's simply, it'd be the lowest possible rate. Not to be facetious, but I'm just curious about that. You take either of those arguments to their logical conclusion.
Well, I'm not sure that quite applies to the area of insurance. I think my point is that we feel that since we are providing these kinds of benefits based on the needs and desires of groups, that then it need not be put into legislation.
Mr. Chairman?
I think Representative Achilles had his hand up first. Ted, did you?
No, it was just... It's a little bit redundant, but having thought about it for a while, I'll go ahead and split it out anyway. There does seem to be an inconsistency, John. This is May. 9 months from now is February. I plan to be skiing next February. I've got lots of time to save up the cash for my broken leg.
You're not planning on a broken leg, are you?
I don't, but it seems to me, you know, in terms of the argument you used, I have difficulty seeing the difference.
Well, then maybe I should strike that portion of my test.
Good thing you have two parts to your test.
Representative Kearns.
The previous witnesses spoke to the question of self-destruction. What happens? I'm covered by Blue Cross and the state plan. Let's say I try and off myself, but I'm unsuccessful. Am I covered?
What plan under the state do you have?
I got the full four. I got the
I can't answer that.
I've got the whatever the major medical and all the rest of it is. Your primo class coverage here. If I just try to destroy myself, am I covered by, if I'm not successful, if I end up in the hospital?
Ralph Bolt's in the audience, and he's the administrator of the state employee benefits. If I might defer that to him.
I'm not going
to
answer that question, Seth.
Yes, you are.
Thank you. Thank you. So I am covered if I try to destroy myself.
If you self-destruct, yes.
If I'm unsuccessful in attempting to destroy myself, and I then go to the hospital, and they patch the hole up in my temple and whatever else that needs to be done, and all the massive surgery and et cetera, if I'm not successful in stuffing myself, then I'll get that covered.
Yes.
And that's something I probably wouldn't be planning on. I could either plan it or not. Depends on how you want to look at it and which way you want to play the game as far as this testimony is considered this afternoon. But I think that's the inconsistency that really has got you hung. I just see that as really hanging you up.
I consider myself hung.
You want to explain that to you? I'm glad that you could come before the committee this Friday afternoon.
May I be excused, Mr.
Chairman?
Mr. Chairman, it's not directed at this witness, I guess, but I think another fallacy in the testimony was the statement that this would increase health care costs, and unless this caused more women to become pregnant than are becoming pregnant now, then it would not indeed increase health care costs. It might redistribute them, but the health care costs are going to be the same, and that's why I personally feel we should be looking at nationalized health insurance instead of these little piecemeal approaches.
Would you like to amend this? Barbara Hutchison. We might do something monumental here today.
Could somebody explain to me where this bill mandates pregnancy coverage? I can't quite read it into it.
It doesn't mandate pregnancy coverage, but it says that in your employee fringe benefits, you may not discriminate on the basis of pregnancy. So if, as an employer, you offer a health insurance plan, it presumably then would have to cover pregnancy the same as other temporary disability.
So the other side of the coin would be that if the employee group wanted to bargain for the same thing under their health program, would that be the other side? We either pass it by law or they have the opportunity to bargain for it in their collective bargaining agreements?
Well, I wouldn't say it's an either-or thing. Yes, employee groups can bargain for it now.
So the net effect, when they come here for law on it, they've not been successful the other route. Is that a fair assumption or an unfair assumption?
Well, Well, I think statistically, the majority of women workers are not unions in the state.
They work under non.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Do you have copies of my testimony?
Yes, we
okay.
do.
And before I start, Gretchen Kapori wanted you to know that she came in and had to leave for Portland and had hoped to be able to speak to you all, but had to leave town.
We'll record her as a proponent.
My name is Barbara Hutchison. Senate Bill 714 is a very important piece of legislation. 13 states have laws covering pregnancy-related disabilities, and 26 states Fair Employment Practice agencies follow the EEOC guidelines relating to pregnancy and childbirth. The Gilbert decision, this was the United States Supreme Court GE Gilbert decision, which was handed down in December, is simply an interpretation of Title VII of the Federal Civil Rights Act of 1964. It is not binding upon state courts or agencies in interpreting their own state human rights laws. Oregon needs such a law. Unfair policies and practices pervade our institutions. The following example makes this clear, and its implications are obvious. In early January 1973, a person we will call John Jones, a co-teacher of mine, decided he wanted to have a vasectomy. He did not officially notify the district of his plans in advance, nor did he plan for a substitute, other than leaving his usual lesson plans. On an early Monday morning, he phoned the school district office, informed them that he was sick and would not be back to school for a few days. He was not required to identify the cause of his illness or disability, and was granted the use of his accrued sick leave for those days off. A few weeks later, on Friday, January 26th, I left school after teaching my last class for the day, knowing that any day could be my last in the classroom for a while, as I was 9 months pregnant. I had spent the last 2 weeks hand-picking a substitute teacher whom I knew to be qualified, one that my students could learn from and whom they liked. I went over detailed lesson plans with her. On Saturday, January 27th, the next day, I gave birth to a child. The machinery for my absence from school was smoothly set in motion. I returned to school and my teaching responsibilities 3 Mondays later. Upon return to work, I requested that I be allowed 15 days of my accrued sick leave. School district practice was to make no attempt to determine the specific disability for which a teacher requested sick leave, and teachers merely completed a form which asked for the date of the absence and whether the leave was sick or vacation. Each teacher at the beginning of the year is given 10 days of sick leave to be used. If all of the days are not used in a given day, the days are carried over to the following year, so in effect a teacher has his or her own private bank account of earned sick days. The school board refused my request for the use of sick leave based on the fact that pregnancy was not deemed to be an illness or injury, but rather a temporary disability permitting leave without pay. They indicated to me that my condition was voluntary and that I had a choice as to whether I wanted to be a mother or be a teacher. It is interesting to note that a man is not asked to make a choice between being a parent and having a career. It is also pertinent in reference to the term voluntary that other illnesses, injuries, or disabilities, which are obviously voluntary, are not called into question. Some of these might include sports injuries, attempted suicide, injuries from a fight, cosmetic surgery, hangovers, and venereal disease. Risks such as prostatectomies, vasectomies, and circumcisions that are specific to the reproductive system of men and for which there are no female counterparts are covered. Pregnancy is the only disability, sex-specified or otherwise, that is excluded from coverage. Other female disabilities are covered, except the most prevalent, pregnancy. After exhausting all possible administrative remedies, I brought a suit against the school board, citing Title VII and the guidelines of the EEOC for enforcing it, and the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Title VII states, Disabilities caused by pregnancy, miscarriage, abortion, childbirth, and recovery therefrom are, for all job-related purposes, temporary disabilities and should be treated as such under any health or temporary disability insurance or sick leave plan available in connection with employment. My case was the first one to bring the issue into the open in this state, and the district court affirmed my contention that the school district was indeed discriminating. The Circuit Court of Appeals for Oregon's district also concurred that the school district was in violation of Title VII. Besides the Ninth Circuit, five other circuits who have addressed this issue, the Second, Third, Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Circuits, have all found in agreement. As a result of taking this action, I lost my teaching position for the following year and have since been labeled a troublemaker by other Oregon school districts. Before concluding, I would like to make some general comments for your consideration. A working woman with a normal pregnancy and delivery is worth about 3 months' salary to the doctor in the hospital. How do we pay for this? The majority of working women cannot afford to lose even a few days of salary, to say nothing of the possibility of losing her job as a result of filing a grievance or bringing a lawsuit against her employer. When a woman is forced to take a leave without pay, the continuity of employment relationships breaks down. There is a financial burden to women workers, and women's comparative transit role in the labor force is exaggerated. Women make up 52% of the nation's population. 40% are in the labor force. More than 60% of all the female labor force is made up of married women. And in the field of education, 67% of all teachers are women. Women potentially have superior numerical strength at the ballot box, and of births, 100% are born by the female. Obviously, the general classification of women as a minority isn't predicated on numbers, but rather on powerlessness. Poor and minority group women cannot afford being powerless, nor can they afford to be treated unequally or unfairly as compared to their male co-workers. These women do not have the option of staying home. I would like to conclude by saying that we need vigorous legislative action at both the state and the national levels to make the intent of the law so clear that there can be no room for statutory interpretation and no court can quibble with its intent.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Mr. Bill Hansen.
Good afternoon. I'm Bill Hansen, and I'm here representing 84 member hospitals of the Oregon Association of Hospitals in opposition to Senate Bill 714. Rather than to get into a philosophical and sometimes emotional discussion as to whether denying paid maternity benefits and sick leave plans is discriminatory, as employers in a labor-intensive industry, we must oppose Senate Bill 714 on the basis of increased health care costs. Some of our hospitals already provide this benefit in their employee benefits package. We simply wish to retain the option as a management decision, as our budgets may allow, or as an item for negotiation in collective bargaining. In other words, we wish to consider paid maternity leave as any other benefit and allow employers to provide it if they can afford it.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Mr. Hansen, in the case of the employees that you're referring to in your particular situation, are most of those female employees?
Yes.
Mixture of male and female.
In our hospitals?
Yes.
I would guess about 90% of the employees in our hospitals are female.
Further questions? Representative Byron.
What's the wage scale of those employees? What's, exclude the registered practical nurse, what would, are most of them in what wage category?
Well, excluding those categories, the wage scale is would be probably better than most industry, other industries, on account of the other highly paid professional people, such as my wife, who is a registered med tech.
Mr. Hansen, of the hospitals that you represent, how many of them, or how many have their employees, all of their employees, under collective bargaining agreements?
Let's see. Maybe I can answer it this way. We have 84 hospitals. We have 85 collective bargaining contracts. Two-thirds of our hospitals have at least one contract. One of our hospitals, Emmanuel in Portland, has seven collective bargaining contracts.
I assume that some of those contracts are, for example, with registered nurses?
28 of them.
Some of them are with classified employees?
Yes, like medical specialties, med techs, x-ray techs, other technical groups, and Service Workers International, and operating engineers and so forth.
Those that weren't under collective bargaining agreements probably couldn't propose that as a matter for bargaining, could they?
Well, yes, it has been. As a matter of fact,
even if they don't bargain an agreement, they could?
It can be an item for bargaining, and has been. The inclusion of that benefit, just as the inclusion of, let's say, eight paid holidays rather than seven, is an item for negotiation.
Mr. Hansen, let's take the registered nurses, the 28 contracts. How many of them have that provision in it? How many of those 28 contracts have a provision?
Well, I think about 15% of them do, merely by not stating that it's excluded as a specific exclusion. Normally, the language in a sick leave policy that an employee would have would specifically exclude pregnancy in the sick leave plan, and if they don't exclude it normally, then they allow it. And many of our hospitals do.
15%.
I would say about 15%. The last time we checked it. Mm-hmm.
Representative Vine,
do any hospitals give employee discount type situations?
Yes, I would say about half our hospitals give employee discounts. But the discounts usually come in after insurance benefits have been paid. Say there's a $700 bill and the insurance benefits pay $600, well, then there may be a percentage discount on the balance.
One more question. Do you?
Another question. Go ahead.
I was interested with the fact that doctors don't charge each other. You know, I guess they make enough money off us, they don't have to charge each other. But I just wondered how prevalent that would be in the case of a hospital. I'm concerned about the disparity between the people that do the menial work in the hospital, which are almost all women, and the people who are, you know, the higher skilled, the nurses and so on. And I wonder if they're all treated equally within the hospital as to the benefits available and the discounts. And can the RN have a baby cheaper in a hospital than the dishwasher?
No, I wouldn't say so. I would say that all employees are treated equally. I'm not saying they're always treated fairly.
Yeah.
And I would say that probably the physicians don't charge each other because maybe they're afraid to. I don't know. But I wouldn't really know how to answer that. Other than that, the employees in hospitals, the female employees, are not all in menial jobs. A good many of them are in darn good, highly respected jobs, and we're kind of proud of that in the industry.
Well, okay.
Representative Achilles.
Mr. Hansen, as I gather, your testimony is based strictly on the premise that it's available optionally and shouldn't be mandated.
Yes, sir.
That's the senator. You heard the prior witness's testimony, Barbara Hutchison's. It was good testimony. It was well put together, and it appeals to me, quite frankly. I'd be interested in having your response to that, if not verbally now, perhaps in writing. It seems to me she brought up some points that are indicative of, over a period of time, differences being allowed to go into the system, differences of treatment between the male and female sex.
Yes, sir.
Would you
be
willing to do that?
Yes.
Appreciate it.
I would be pleased to do that.
Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much, Mr. Hanson. Is someone going to testify for Senator Roberts, Mary Roberts? I saw her back there for a while.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Richard Lee, and I'm representing Senator Mary Roberts this afternoon. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Senate Bill 714 is a long overdue clarification of Oregon's civil rights statutes regarding discrimination against women in employment practices. Senate Bill 714 would consider pregnancy, childbirth, and related medical conditions in women the same as any other physical or mental condition in men or women which affects employment. There's a long list of physical impairments peculiar to either men or women. In all but one of these general areas, men and women are both treated with consideration in their employment by allowing both sick leave and appropriate benefits. In one area peculiar to women, however, this is not the case. And this discriminatory employment practice goes beyond discrimination against women. In a modern society where men and women are both employed and in a family situation both contribute to the total family income, this is a form of discrimination against the family. Only 7% of American families consist of a married couple with a husband working full-time while the wife is not employed outside of the home. The other 93% include single-parent families, families in which the wife is the breadwinner, and families in which both partners are employed outside the home. Woman's economic contribution to a family unit is not a second or supplementary income. Income is income, and in most families, it is all badly needed to meet rising living expenses. If a man and a woman decide to have a child, a very common and normal decision, then why should the woman be faced with losing her job or the position she has achieved or her income and medical leave benefits? Why should the family suffer this loss of immediate income, this loss of potential income, or this loss of medical leave benefits? The woman's loss is the family's loss. The entire unit suffers because she is placed in this secondary situation. This situation is only worsened when the husband is not around, is not able to provide an adequate income to cover family expenses, or not employed at all. With our high unemployment rates now, it is not uncommon to find a family where one parent is not producing an income. Should that parent be the father and the mother's income be lost because of her pregnancy, the family as a unit would suffer greatly. There have been many landmark decisions across the country covering different aspects of the same employment discrimination, every other one setting a different precedent, leaving the courts with a pick-and-choose approach to prohibiting discrimination on the basis of sex. It is clearly up to the legislature to spell out the law, saying that women and the family will not suffer discrimination because of a wage-earning mother's temporary physical disability, pregnancy. That pregnancy, childbirth, and related medical conditions shall be regarded as any other physical or medical condition which affects their ability or inability to provide their family with economic support. Let me now deal with a number of the conventional questions which may be raised in your minds. First, is this indeed a question of equality, of equal treatment and protection, or of prevention of discrimination? Women's Rights Coalition, a coalition of women's groups from across the state which requested the introduction of this bill, believes that it is. I hope that you do also. Surely you would agree that it is inconsistent to say that it is illegal to discriminate against women in employment, but legal to discriminate against persons, male or female, on the basis of pregnancy, or that it is legal to allow sick leave for male or female employees to get vasectomies, but not for pregnancy. Obviously, discrimination on the basis of a specific sex-related condition
is discrimination. Second, some have suggested that it is wrong to allow the same benefits and privileges for those who become pregnant as for those who are medically unable to work for other reasons, because pregnancy is voluntary. I need not point out to the members of the committee that pregnancy is not necessarily voluntary. The act which may result in pregnancy obviously is voluntary, and that same activity may result in other disabling conditions, like venereal disease. In the case of pregnancy, however, because of biological differences, only one of the couple, the woman, risks disability. And speaking of voluntary disabilities, don't insurance companies usually provide coverage for sick leaves due to such disabilities as weekend football injuries, skiing accidents, barroom brawls, or overindulgence in alcohol or drugs? I say that it is not unreasonable that a pregnant woman who is medically certified as being unable to work because of her condition be entitled to the same number of paid or unpaid medical leave days as she would be entitled to for any other disabling condition. This bill does not require an employer to grant medical leave to a woman capable of working. This bill does not provide any more medical leave to a pregnant woman than she has accrued. If an employer provides no medical leave for male or female employees, there would be no change in policy. If an employer provides 1 week per year medical leave for all employees, then that 1 week per year would not be altered. The bill simply says that whatever the employer's policy, it will apply equally to men and to women. Some have said, okay, it's fair, but what about the cost? Can we afford this? I hope that cost is not the key factor in your resolve to prevent discrimination on the basis of race, religion, national origin, or of sex. The issue of cost was not raised when the Oregon legislature moved our state further towards racial equality. I did not hear the issue of cost raised when this body voted overwhelmingly for the ratification of the Equal Rights Amendment. There's a human cost involved here that outweighs other cost considerations. If you want the total cost picture, I ask you to recognize the significance of welfare statistics. Over 90% of all families on aid to dependent children welfare are single parent families consisting of mothers and their children. It would be interesting to see that cost, the cost of punishing women who will be and are mothers by letting their pregnancy cause them to lose their jobs, lose job reinstatement rights, lose seniority, tenure, rights to leave, retirement credit, health coverage, and destroy their families economically. Look at what results this has had. Many of you have struggled to design programs to get our people off welfare and back to work. With this bill, we could go a long way towards putting women back in the workforce where they belong. The employers who provide a health plan as a fringe benefit will have to review their plans in light of the bill. Many will find their plans already in compliance. Others will have a number of options. One option is for them to reduce other benefits offered, perhaps scratching cosmetic surgery from their plans. There may not be a need to raise the cost of coverage 1 cent if the employer chooses not to. Senator Roberts has tremendous respect for the managerial skills of business persons, and there are many ways in which insurance plans could be altered to comply. Pregnancy discrimination is a form of sex discrimination understood by every woman who has ever applied for work and been asked about her childbearing plans. Too many employers have set this up as a roadblock to women pursuing careers. A more realistic and more enlightened attitude would put pregnancy and childbirth into perspective as a temporary physical disability which should simply be treated as sick leave. I hope you will support a DuPass recommendation for this bill.
Thank you very much. Are you prepared to answer questions for Senator Roberts?
I would prefer to answer questions for myself and not put words in.
All right. Are there any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hank Crawford?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Hank Crawford, and I'm here representing OPS Blue Shield. With a bill that speaks to so many matters of discrimination and so forth, such as this, it's a little difficult to sit here and say that we're speaking against the bill. So let me rephrase it and say that that we are against the portions of the bill that talk to the insurance situation only. I think that Mr. Lansing pretty well summed up the position that insurance companies must find themselves in, and this and other types of legislation that talk about increased coverages. And I think what he said to needs to be said again. The financial portion to the insurance company is not really the question here, within certain limits. And I'd like to explain those limits to you. First of all, though, let me say that there is a terrible fear that with inflation in costs of goods and services in the healthcare field as well as every other field that you and I know about, with the constant adding to insurance policies, and it's certainly no secret for those of you who have served more than one session here that this has been going on for some time in this legislative body, we are afraid that we are getting to a point where we are pricing that insurance policy beyond what can be afforded by many, many people. And when and if that does happen, it's a shame. Now, obviously, I'm not going to sit here and tell you or insinuate to you that adding this one more thing is going to put us over that hump. It indeed is not. But as Mr. Lansing pointed out to you, this session there are a number of other bills to add to costs, some of them here in your own committee. So our concern is not for the economy vote PS Blue Shield, at least not at this time, but I can assure you that we are not above becoming selfish enough to worry about the success and continued success of our business to wonder if we get the prices up so high necessarily by what we have to cover that pretty soon there's no market for our product. That would be a concern of ours. We're not there yet. We know that. We're talking in terms now, and this is a general average because it will change from group to group to some degree, but we're talking in terms of $90 premiums a month for families. That's a lot of money. A lot is being done in the field of medicine, and most of you know that I also represent the Oregon Medical Association in this legislature. And despite the fact that Representative Vian and others would love to have an economic discussion regarding physicians' fees and so forth, I can assure you that we'll be happy to sit down with you by the hour and show you detailed plans that are working to lower costs in lots of areas of medicine. So it's a ballgame that we all have to cooperate in order to get someplace. And when it's presented to you in the form that it's presented to you in Senate Bill 714, it becomes even more difficult to deal with because there are obviously so many aspects of this bill that are good. I suppose what I would ask is that together, you and the insurance industry, we might look at this, consider some amendments to it of some kind. Maybe we can encourage, I've heard the lack of collective bargaining, the lack of input. Certainly you've heard me testify before on insurance matters and know that what OPS Blue Shield wants is to have more input from whatever group it is to what do you want, not less. Maybe there's something that needs to be done in that field that could help rather than this kind of an approach. And I think that we have to get to the very basic philosophy, call it planned, call it voluntary. I don't really think that's terribly important any more than the ski trip is. But we have to get to a point where we say we can afford on our own to take risks for certain things, certain disabilities, whatever they are, and we cannot afford to on others. And sometime way back a long time ago, we started getting away from that pattern when it came to legislating matters in insurance. And the day we made that break was a very sad day for the consumer of those services. And I would hate to see us get into it any farther, where, as it's been pointed out, we're talking about people who an insurance policy is written for who may have absolutely no need for the services whatsoever. In total, 100% of the people in a given industry are. And so I guess that's it. Mr. Chairman, from our point of view. Should you decide to pass this law, I assure you OPS Blue Shield will continue to be in business. But I can also assure you that most of the policies will have an increase in premium. I also agree with those who say there can be, as Senator Roberts has said in her testimony, some jockeying and some lopping off of other benefits. But for the most part, those benefits have been written because the majority of people have shown a need for the services. And there are probably few that could be lopped off. In fact, facetiously, I might say to you, the only ones that probably would be worthy of being lopped off would be those that you've already mandated in past sessions. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Crawford, do you think there's any credibility to Senator Roberts' testimony in regards to the social or human cost, for example, vis-a-vis welfare, some of the costs that are borne by all the taxpayers in the state, and why the state legislature in the past has mandated certain coverages? If there's any credibility to that argument?
I think there's some credibility to it. I think it still is a point to be argued, and the point is that we, all along the line, in this terrific process that you and I share in, we have to make those decisions. Is it worth it? Because we all have agreed a long time ago that it really isn't free. And we have to discover whether or not it's worth the price. I feel that my job, what I've come before you for, is to tell you that there is indeed a dear price to pay. We've been paying it for a long time. We may be getting to the point where the bank doesn't have enough money to pay it.
Representative Vine.
Well, just to clarify for the record, that I'm glad that Mr. Crawford realized my concern about medical fees, and I am indeed concerned about the fact that some people seem to be getting tremendously wealthy on the suffering of others. You know, that message could be taken directly to the OMA or the AMA, and I find it shameful that the taxpayers of any state or this nation as a whole are asked to educate people so they can get into a high enough income bracket so they can work 2 or 3 days a week and make people wait in line for weeks and months to get into a doctor's office. And I'm certainly willing to do anything in my power to bring them back down to earth and to pay them what they're worth.
Mr. Chairman.
I don't think the previous representative's testimony has a damn thing to do with this bill.
I think that was simply a comment.
Right. He made the comment. Hey, so you can fight it out with him. We don't have to do it publicly.
Gentlemen.
Can I move to the other end of that?
Did you notice how quiet I got, Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Crawford.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I don't care.
I think they're both working on Sony Grant.
Nancy Ruiz.
Move the right side of the table adjourned. Does that work?
Actually,
you can stay, Wayne.
Shut up. I don't have to shut up. Jesus Christ. I don't have to shut up even.
I may tell both of you to be quiet in just a moment, please. It would please be courteous to the next witness. Thank you.
My name is Nancy Ruiz. I reside at, my office is at 1418 Northwest 9th, Corvallis, Oregon. I am employed as a UNISERV consultant by the Oregon Education Association and am testifying today in favor of Senate Bill 714 on their behalf. The legislation being discussed today has major impact on women teachers of the state of Oregon, and women continue to make up the majority of this workforce. It is my conviction that Senate Bill 714 should be adopted for the following reasons. At present, the employment practices of the school districts do discriminate because of sex. One area in particular stands out. It is the continued denial of sick leave for pregnancy-related disabilities due to childbirth. A teacher, both male and female, earns at least 10 days per year of sick leave. This leave is cumulative and part of a teacher's total economic compensation. However, pregnant women are not allowed to use this earned leave for childbirth or related illnesses. The districts argue that pregnancy is voluntary, yet school districts allow sick leave for other voluntary illnesses, such as emphysema, cirrhosis of the liver, injuries incurred in sports activities, voluntary surgeries, including vasectomies. Present practice places an unfair economic hardship on women. The paid sick leave was legislated to provide economic protection during times when the teacher was physically unable to work. By denying sick leave for pregnancy purposes, the family of a pregnant teacher suffers a severe financial burden. The loss of $40 to $60 a day for a 3 to 4 week period. This financial burden affects families where the wife's salary contribution is an integral and essential part of the family income. At present, there is a disparity among districts in their granting of sick leave for pregnancy purposes. Some districts have agreed in collective bargaining agreements to grant sick leave for childbirth purposes. Other districts have adopted board policy that allows use of sick leave. Others have responded that they see no problem with the use of sick leave for pregnancy, but don't want to set a precedent and have opted to abide by any related Supreme Court decisions. One district in my area grants sick leave for pregnancy-related illnesses up to the day of the child's birth. Other districts deny any use of sick leave for pregnancy or childbirth purposes. Senate Bill 714 would provide equitable and uniform treatment of women teachers in the state of Oregon. In our schools today, there is an emphasis being placed on assuring young women that equal educational opportunities are available for all. Furthermore, young women are being encouraged to develop their economic potential to the fullest. Yet in these same classrooms, pregnant women teachers are being denied their economic benefits for no other reason than the fact that they are women. In summary, the state of Oregon can no longer allow this type of discrimination to continue to such a degree against its own citizenry. Because continuing to deny the use of sick leave for pregnancy disability is discriminating against all of the citizens of Oregon. I thank you for your time and interest, and if you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Nancy. Questions by the committee? Good to see you again.
Okay, thank you.
A former colleague of mine.
That's what you used to do, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that. Steve Telfer. The committee will note I'm fairly alternating between the opponents and the proponents.
We have
want
a
the
question.
Committee
how
to note that
committee,
my even-handedness.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the order. It's appropriate, I guess, that I follow the opponent OEA. I represent the Association of Oregon Counties, the Oregon School Boards Association, the League of Oregon Cities.
The arm of management.
I wish to state right at the outset that I am speaking today on behalf of the legislative committees of those three organizations which have not taken a position, either in favor of or in support, or in opposition, this bill. However, I felt, as Mr. Crawford expressed in his testimony, that it is important that the committee be aware of the estimated fiscal impact of the bill, particularly with respect to our health and accident policies, which are sponsored by the three organizations. It's our estimate that the impact for cities, counties, and school districts combined would be approximately $3.5 million for the coming biennium.
Steve, what percent is that of total cost and benefits in that category paid, you know?
I don't know, Chairman, what that would be as a percentage figure. Right now, the average premium tends to run in the neighborhood of $30 to $40, depending again on which of the various levels of insurance policy that are offered. As the state,
we're talking about a potential increase in that premium of being what?
Oh, probably $5, roughly.
Thank you.
The one other issue that I'd like to raise has to do with an interpretation of the bill. We're not really very sure what the intent was of dealing with the issue of pregnancy conceptually treated as any other illness. Does the bill, in fact, intend that as soon as the pregnancy occurs and is known about, that that, in fact, constitutes illness? Or does it, in fact, say that when the pregnant woman's doctor certifies that she is unable to work, that that, in fact, constitutes disability and or illness? The only reason for raising that point is it seems to me there is the potential for abuse of sick leave policies if, in fact, pregnancy is treated as an illness at that first point in time when the woman understands or knows she is pregnant. The logical answer here is there ought to be some relationship to a certification, a medical certification, that in fact there is inability to work because of pregnancy, it seemed to me. Secondly, I can't help but observe that there's been a lot of reference in previous testimony about pregnancy versus vasectomy, and I find that a little unusual because normally insurance policies of the health and accident nature have a comparable benefit for tubal ligations, which seem to be the more appropriate comparable to a vasectomy. And I also find it's a little interesting that sport injuries, for example, seem to be implied to be only happening to males. I think it's equally possible that a gal skiing is likely to have a broken leg and hence also covered under normal insurance policy. Thank you. I'd be happy to respond to questions.
Questions for Steve? Representative Vine.
Well, concerning the comment about sick leave, wouldn't you traditionally have so much sick leave
accrued?
Yeah, 10 days or 20 days or 7 days or...
Well, as the witness immediately preceding me indicated, there is a variety of sick leave policy amongst public sector agencies around the state.
But this wouldn't this legislation simply say that you have X number of sick days and you can take them for pregnancy, or you can take them just because you don't feel like coming into work?
Yeah. That's the question I'm raising. What, in fact, is the intent of the legislation? Is it to say that the first day after you are aware that you're pregnant, are you then ill, quote-unquote, and unable to work, and therefore able to draw sick leave?
Well, I would think that...
Or does it mean that there should be, in fact, certification upon the part of a doctor saying that you are now unable to work, and hence...
See, the point I'm trying to make is if you have 10 days of sick leave and if you decide you're sick the first day you find out you're pregnant, 10 days later you're out of sick leave.
That's correct.
And then if you get fired from your job, then it's not discrimination because of sick leave. It's discrimination because you don't have any time.
We take that same example into a situation with a teacher who has been employed for several years and has had a good work experience with very minimal illness. There's potential for having accrued substantially in excess of 10 days, in fact, to the point where it could be very close to or in excess of 9 months.
Mr. Chairman, one more question. On the other hand, we got an employee that has a good work record, worked for the state of Oregon or as a school teacher, and has 180 days of sick leave coming. Isn't it feasible that she could just take 180 days of sick leave?
Certain.
Whether she's pregnant or not?
Certain. If, in fact, she's unable to work, I think there would be a challenge if, in fact, there was no certification.
If she was unable to work, that's the key.
That's what I'm driving at here. It's a matter of how is it we determine the inability to work.
Okay.
Further questions?
Thank you very much, Steve.
Mr. Paul Frederick.
Sharon suggests that we create a licensing board to certify pregnancies.
Probably the Phoebe.
I can't see that you're doing it.
I noticed the Merrimack is still floating over there.
You noticed that this afternoon?
Yes, I did.
And Carl Frederick, a member of the staff associated with Oregon Industries, and I have with me Mr. Everett Cobb, Jr., treasurer of Janssen. And I'd like to give kind of an overview of our position and then have Mr. Cobb give some specifics as to the cost impacts, impact of Senate Bill 714. I think that, I think the philosophical questions as to whether pregnancy and other related medical conditions are similar to other physical disabilities or are in fact a disability for purpose of employment-related benefits, I think that's been thoroughly aired and addressed here this afternoon. I think without question all of you have heard and rolled over the various arguments pro and con. But the people we represent are very much concerned about the cost for additional mandated benefits. And particularly in this day and age with the escalating costs of other mandated, government-mandated programs, workers' compensation, unemployment insurance. I mean, let's talk about those for a moment. It's estimated that the cost of workers' comp in Oregon alone is going to be over $300 million this year. And about 5 short years ago, it was just about half of that. Unemployment insurance, this year it's going to be in the area of $168 million. Last year was $140 million. The year before that was only $65 million. So you're talking about some significant employer mandated costs. I can't give you the total fiscal impact of this particular piece of legislation, proposed legislation, on all public and private employers. I've heard some estimates today, and I read about some. I don't think anyone really has all of the figures. But I personally did survey two large employers in the state of Oregon that are highly female labor intensive. And I've got a response from them, and I'll share some of those costs with you. One has a total of 7,400 employees in the state, total female, 56% of those. Their study shows that in the first 4 months in 1976, 45 employees were granted pregnancy leaves. And those leaves granted ranged everywhere from 1 month, 10 days, to 6 months, with an average of 3.25 months per person for a total of 143 months. So based on the year, that would equate to 135 leaves or 429 months with a price tag of $415,218. That's based on an average rate of $967 a month. $415,218. Total cost.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Could you expand on that? Is that assuming that they all have sick leave?
That's assuming they all were paid this disability benefits for that period of time, and they used an average cost for the other types of disability benefits of an average of, I think they used $967 a month. If all of those people were paid on that basis under this particular proposed piece of legislation, the cost for this concern, just for this aspect of it, would be $415,218. Now, I'll leave these figures with you to study.
Yeah, I guess I'm just confused that I wasn't aware that a pregnancy would come under that criterion for a disability. I thought sick leave, yes, but disability?
Yeah. That was the way they interpreted the Senate Bill 714. Now, the other employer, 5,500 employees in the state, 3,900 of them are female. They came up with an impact, and I quote directly from their study to me, Senate Bill 714 will cost between $300,000 to $350,000 a year for our firm with this mandated coverage. Now, perhaps
this point, it'd be good to have Mr. Cobb explain what he has construed the impact of Senate Bill 714 to be on his particular firm, which also is highly female labor intensive.
Mr. Cobb.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to testify regarding Senate Bill 714. I thought, first of all, I should give you a little background on Janssen. Janssen is a major diversified apparel company emphasizing sportswear. It was founded in 1910 by Oregonians and still maintains its headquarters in Portland. They operate 16 production and distribution facilities in 9 states, Puerto Rico, and Canada. Their products are sold by over 12,000 retail outlets, which are serviced by 130 Janssen salesmen. And we have 1,450 employees in Oregon. 80% are female with an average age of 33. We had sales last year, which ended in August of 76, of $124 million. Janssen has always taken very seriously its responsibility for the development and continual updating of its employee benefits program. Present time, our company pays out 37 cents in employee benefits for every $1 of wages. Our program has been thoughtfully designed to include protection for disastrous financial losses caused by accident and illness, to assist in the accumulation of funds for retirement, and to provide for time off to enjoy the holidays and the relaxation of a well-earned vacation. It will come as no surprise to any of you if I say that the subject of pregnancy has been the focal point of considerable debate and argument. Much of the argument has been clouded in the collateral issues of sex discrimination, voluntariness of the condition, and the like. Because of these collateral issues, the subject is, to say the least, fraught with emotion, so much so that many businesses, individuals, and even legislators are reticent about voicing their views on the subject for fear of being labeled anti-motherhood, chauvinists, and other equally repugnant names. I would like to avoid, if possible, becoming enmeshed in that emotional web of thought and address Senate Bill 714 from what I consider to be a pragmatic approach. There is no doubt that the passage of this bill would substantially increase employers' costs. Those of us in industries with high concentrations of female employees will be disproportionately affected. In reviewing our situation at Janssen, and this is the Portland plant only, the additional cost of providing sick pay, disability pay, hospital medical costs will exceed $35,000 per year, or an increase of some 15% of those costs currently. This is based on an average of 20 pregnancies per year at Portland, with an average leave time of 7 weeks. No one can say whether a requirement to provide this type of payment will increase this estimate, but it can reasonably be assured it will not decrease it. Projected over our entire corporation, the cost could easily exceed $75,000 per year. This in and of itself is sufficient justification for us to oppose the legislation. However, there are other considerations which make the bill undesirable. Freedom of choice is definitely a part of our social fabric. Many women and many couples today are choosing to have no children or perhaps only one. If the bill discriminates at all, it is certainly against the woman who chooses not to have children, or more directly against the woman who cannot. We see little logic to requiring employers to provide a benefit to a limited number of employees. As an employer, we strive to provide employee benefits which will help all our employees. We review this continually. Of course, cost is a factor, and therefore we try to provide the largest benefit to the most employees at the fairest cost. We do not feel the passage of Senate Bill 714 will accomplish that end. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Questions? Mr. Cobb, is it?
Cobb, yes.
Yes, question for Mr. Cobb. Representative Bryant.
Is your, are your employees unionized?
No, they're not.
What's the average pay they would receive, a 33-year-old woman employee?
Well, if you're working in a factory, this is probably around $4 an hour.
And does your, you have a health insurance plan?
Yes, we do.
Does it cover vasectomies?
I looked that up when you're asking the question of others, and I'm sure it does. But I really don't see why that, in our cost, the cost of the sick the time off would really be as much or more than the other, and I can't visualize, knowing a couple instances in our case where they had him on a Monday and were playing volleyball on a Wednesday night. It's certainly not like a woman being out for 6 or 7 weeks. So
that's true, and of course a lot of women aren't out 6 or 7 weeks. The reason I asked was because you said it makes little sense to require a benefit for a limited number of employees, and you've only 20% of your employees are male, and I would assume that most of them, or at least half of them, probably wouldn't be in the age where vasectomies would be a legitimate concern. So to me, you're talking about 10% of your employees that you provide a service for, but then again, you say that it doesn't make sense to provide a benefit for a limited number of employees.
Well, we know that over this average of 20, of course, could be shot down next year by having 30, and the year after by having 10, let's say. This is an average, you have to realize.
Depends on the type of winter we have.
Yeah. So by that definition alone, it is fairly.
Maybe an energy crunch. We don't know.
Other questions? Thank you very much, gentlemen. I can now call Jane Barber and Susan Stone, please.
Made a maintenance calculation there.
I'm Jane Barber from Tektronix. At the request of the committee, I'm here to testify about 714. Tech is neither for nor against the bill. We are simply here to describe our experiences in administering benefit plans in which pregnancy-related disabilities are treated as nearly as possible like any other disability. As employee benefits manager, I had responsibility for setting up the benefits plans. In October 1972, Tech implemented a company-funded short-term disability plan which provided partial income replacement benefits to employees unable to work due to illness or injury. The EEOC had issued a regulation in April of 1972 stating that disabilities caused by pregnancy or childbirth were to be treated the same as any other temporary disability. So we decided to administer our new salary continuation plan in conformance with the regulation. We knew of no other companies with similar programs, so we had to develop our own administrative guidelines. We began to experience major interpretation problems almost immediately. When talking in the abstract, it sounds easy to say disabilities caused by pregnancy will be treated the same as other disabilities. It's quite another thing to explain what you mean by that. Normal pregnancy is a state of good health, not illness. At what point does a woman with a normal pregnancy begin to experience disabilities caused by pregnancy? At first, we naively assumed the treating physician would answer the question. However, we found this assumption to be false. Practically, our first claim was from an employee who was 3 months pregnant and whose doctor said she needed to stop work. When we asked the doctor what was the matter with her, he said nothing, but she said Tech had a program to pay pregnant women and she needed a note from her doctor. We, of course, did not pay her disability benefits until much later in her pregnancy, but that claim was symptomatic of what we repeatedly encountered. Some employees thought that being pregnant was the same as being disabled. And many of them who had begun to make plans to leave work before becoming or after becoming pregnant were disappointed to find that they were going to have to continue working. The idea that pregnancy is a state of good health rather than a disability is key to our plan. Also, physicians were not accustomed to determining whether a pregnant woman was able to work, or I should say here, a normally pregnant woman was able to work, and they weren't very happy about having to do so. Up until then, physicians were only required to determine whether pregnancy existed and to provide appropriate medical treatment. Virtually every pregnancy claim required substantially more administrative expense than a claim for any other kind of disability because we continually had to explain the intent of the plan and seek further definition as to whether disability truly existed. We finally modified our policy and reduced some of the problem of disappointed expectations. The modification also served to get the doctor off the hook to some degree. We took the position of assuming a woman with a normal pregnancy was able to work until the expected date of delivery, We equated it to a situation where an employee is going in for scheduled surgery. To be eligible for benefits before the delivery or surgery date, earlier medical problems must be substantiated by the physician. The administrative problems did not go away after the plan modification. Maternity-related claims will, by their nature, always be more difficult to administer in a way that is fair to all employees. For instance, when an employee must stop work due to other temporary disabilities, generally he or she returns to work upon recovery and once again is a productive employee. In the case of a childbirth-related disabilities, a very large number decide not to return. So we, in essence, have provided a termination settlement, not provided other employees. Also, the employer has the added expense of training a replacement. In the last 2 year span, we had 215 maternity childbirth disability claims. Of those, 31% elected to terminate rather than return to work after the birth of their child. The question of the cost of the program must also be considered. We have not found it to be as great as some of the articles would suggest. However, it is significant. The add-on costs for maternity-related disability coverage that we experienced averaged about 19% of claims. And this does not include the cost of administration or of training replacements. In summary, we found it difficult but not impossible to administer our programs such that maternity and childbirth are treated similarly to other medical conditions. And we believe this committee and others should be aware of the problems because they are very real. On the other hand, a woman with a serious medical condition such as toxemia is just as ill whether the illness is caused by pregnancy or any other reason. And a woman in the hospital is unable to work for medical reasons, whether the reason is surgery or childbirth. And although 31% of the women who take pregnancy disability terminate and in effect are getting extra termination pay, 69% return to work. Obviously, this is not an easy problem. There are definite pros and cons on the pregnancy benefits issue, and we hope our experiences will help the committee resolve this difficult point. We would like to add one other point that we think should be made. The cost to employers of measures like Senate Bill 714 are eventually passed on to the consumer. There simply is no magic pocket from which to take funds. When Oregon passes legislation unique to this state, Oregon products become more expensive than those from other states, and this can damage our competitive position. I'm not indicating that Senate Bill 714 should not pass for this reason, but we feel that it is important to be cognizant of the problem and consider Senate Bill 714 along with other legislation in a manner that keeps Oregon businesses competitive.
Thank you very much, Jane. Questions? I have a question in regard to cost. Do you have any other figures? Did you bring any other figures along as to for example, the actual dollar cost increased per year, the first year you experienced that, say, 72, 73, or any other way that we could measure?
No, it was pretty difficult to measure because we shifted from a totally employee-paid plan that only applied to a portion of our employees and paid a benefit of $60 a month regardless of income to a plan that covered all employees and paid 60% of pay and added maternity at the same time. So it was pretty difficult to find any comparability there. Costs have, for the total, say the last 2 years, which were the figures I was looking at most recently, for the total program of salary continuation have run about between about $800,000 for all claims, and the maternity portion of it has been about $140,000. Now, we also have sick pay that's been alluded to here. People can accumulate sick pay at the rate of, well, it adds up to 10 days a year and can carry it across to another year. And that does come in front of the salary continuation program. So for the average employee, they would receive maybe 10 days of sick pay and then go into the salary continuation program. I'm not really able to identify the cost for that because it's just run through the system. We don't say sick pay for maternity or sick pay for back or that sort of thing, but estimating, you know, if you assume that everybody had 10 days, you would add, I think I was figuring a little while ago, you would add about another $70,000 to that 140 that I mentioned. In our experience there at Keck. Now, this is not addressing our health plans.
Nice. Thank you. Representative Achilles?
Jane, the last, or next last paragraph of your testimony, you refer to this as legislation unique to this state. Seem to recall, I don't see it in the testimony up here, that somebody else said there were several other states that did have legislation like this. Are you aware of?
Generally, the point we're making, trying to make there was, it's, you know, our expectation that probably this will pass on the national scene, and at that point it would be an equal application to all employers everywhere, rather than individual states passing legislation that affects their industries somewhat negatively then.
I see. Thank you.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, it might be interesting to note that if you were going to get sick leave for the full duration of the pregnancy, one of the people in the audience told me that it would take 27 years of accumulation of 10 days a year sick leave to qualify. So you'd be about 47 when you got before you could qualify.
Why not? Too many people would avail themselves of that opportunity.
Yeah. I'd like to point out in the audience, to answer questions you already met Pat Hagen, she's provided the committee with the U.S. EEOC guidelines on sex discrimination, outlining the policy on pregnancy. And that is the policy that the Bureau of Labor is currently using in interpreting the sex discrimination statute. Also in the audience is Ralph Bolt with the State of Oregon benefits. And the State of Oregon employees may use their sick leave for maternity benefits. There's also provision for leave without pay for maternity leave. And either of those people are available if you have questions.
And one remaining witness. Mary Salbert. You fine? You want to testify today and come back to work session two if you'd like? All right. I mean, after all, why is that? Besides that, I want to hear who all you represent, Mary. You always have such an impressive list.
Is that what that is? You want to get close enough to read one.
My name is Mary Sather. I'm the lobbyist for the Women's Rights Coalition, which is a group of 11 women's organizations. I hope I don't have to read through them, but I will if you want. Okay. First, I'd like to mention that we do feel that Senate Bill 714 is a civil rights sex discrimination issue, and that fundamentally, and an insurance issue second, and that discussing that issue is not clouding the concerns that are presented here. I have distributed a letter that was presented by Carol Hewitt, who's an attorney, who was Barbara Hutchinson's attorney and still is, in her discrimination suit, and she's very knowledgeable in this area of civil rights and discrimination. Also, some testimony from Jane Edwards, who is the personnel in the personnel division for the state of Oregon. I'd like to comment initially, too, that I've spoken with a representative of Multnomah County personnel director, who says that pregnancy-related conditions are treated just the same as all other disabilities under their plan. It's also treated the same for sick leave purposes and all other medical benefits. So I thought that was an interesting comment.
some points that Carol Hewitt made that I thought were relevant. On the second page, when the Gilbert decision was handed down, I was immediately concerned that employers would view the case as an invitation to expand pregnancy discrimination beyond the realm of granting or denying sick leave. My fears were confirmed when approximately 2 weeks after the decision, I received a phone call from an employee of a major corporation in Oregon who had been told that she would be summarily terminated when she left her job to give birth. The woman requested that she be allowed to use her two-week vacation for the birth, but was told that it was inconvenient for the company to have her take her vacation at the needed time. Because her accrued sick leave was not available for any pregnancy-related disability, and because she could not take her vacation, the woman was faced with the loss of her job because she could not be at work for a period of approximately 2 weeks. If pregnancy discrimination is not sex discrimination, as the Gilbert decision holds, employers are legally free to treat pregnant employees in any manner they desire. This is grossly unfair. On the third page of her letter, the second most common argument raised against equal treatment for all disabilities is that it would be too costly. This subject has been dealt with at great length in numerous briefs filed in court cases involving this issue. Both sides have compiled statistics to support their positions. In considering this argument, it should be remembered that virtually every employer establishes a maximum amount of leave which is available for various purposes. It is no more costly for such leave to be used for one purpose than another. The final point which I would like to make clear to the committee is that Senate Bill 714 does not require employers to grant either sick leave or leave of absence for child rearing. The bill is confined strictly to physical disability caused by conditions which are unique to women. In other words, women would not be granted sick leave for child rearing purposes, only for childbearing purposes. Also, once a woman was determined to be medically able to work, she would not be able to continue her paid or unpaid sick leave, and employers are able to limit the number of weeks of paid sick leave, and that would apply to pregnant women as well as other disabilities. So we're not asking that pregnant women be given special job status or special benefits, just to be treated the same as all others for employment-related purposes.
Question, Mr. Chairman?
Certainly, Representative Morris. Tektronix was mentioning some of the problems that they were having in administering a program in this area. One woman, for example, getting a note from her doctor. Do you have any comments on this problem or this experience that you went through in trying to administer a program?
I prefer that you direct your questions to them because they've been working on it.
In other words, there were some abuses of the system, and it appeared that they had to go through some extraordinary efforts to try and make the system fair. And I'm just asking if you had any comments in relationship to that portion of testimony that was presented.
No, except that on the Senate committee, there was, I can't even remember the testimony, I'd have to dig it up, but someone made a comment that men abuse sick leave more than women do, and I don't know what their source was.
No.
Did you want me to read through Jane Edwards' testimony?
No, that's fine.
I think we have that
on a record, and we'll keep it when we get to our work session.
Okay, that is
advise
the state
the
policy.
To read it.
Right, that is the state policy on the same
state
issue.
Policy, right.
One other comment, and that is that each pregnancy would be treated individually and uniquely, just like an individual's disability would be treated uniquely. And so I'm not sure it's fair for an employer to say that all women would take sick leave or disability leave at the same time, because it depends on the woman's condition and as determined by her doctor or a company doctor. And I think you could ask maybe Tektronix whether they, you know, how they determine that, if they do use a company doctor's opinion on that.
Thank you, Mayor. Is there anyone else wishing to appear on the bill? Not, we're adjourned.